subject today is supposed to be the Christian imagination. I don't know whether... I'm getting so leery of the adjective Christian that I hate to use it. I think we'll just call it the imagination. We'll talk about the imagination in terms of its relationship to human beings and their living and thinking. And we will apply it probably naturally and instinctively to the aspects of our lives that we think of in terms of our relationship to Christ. But I had a big argument with Al Pitcher on this just last week, because I hate to use the word Christian as an adjective, and I know it's used as an adjective, and I use it that way myself. But think about it. Just ask yourself, once in a while, when you use the term Christian as an adjective, ask yourself what you really mean by that term.
Especially when you say a Christian nation.
Well, or a Christian anything. I don't know. I just don't know if they're even a Christian person, or except insofar it is those of you who are taking Greek who understand it in terms of the real meaning of the word genitive, in which you belong to a group of people who belong to Jesus Christ in a particular way. In that respect, I can take it, but not as an adjective of what a fine Christian person he is. That really turns me off, so don't use it about me, because if you think that that's going to impress me, it won't. I'm sure you aren't going to, but I thought I'd warn you in advance. I want you to know, those of you who are here in Koinonia as visitors in the village, as villagers, this talk and discussion is actually a part of the lifestyle program, which is a program for post high school people who have been were finished with high school and who have maybe gone to college, maybe they haven't, but they are interested in a different kind of learning for a year. So I am really addressing them. And if I seem to be looking up above you, that is why I'm looking up above you, because they are not sitting in front of me. There, some of them are sitting up there, and some are sitting back there. But we did feel that we should have it open to as many people as might be interested, and so that's why we are having it in Koinonia rather than in the lifestyle room or up in our chalet, which is where I usually have any sessions that I'm involved in, mainly because it's cleaner. I wash it lots of times a day. I keep the dust up. Nobody, not even Lou, can keep it that clean. Now, the term imagination, I think you can at once see, if you break it down, that it has the word image in it. And therefore, it has the meaning of an image-making meaning to it. That is the effect that you have from the term itself. Now, what kind of images these are depends a lot on the kind of person who is involved in making the images. Please let us get clear of any psychological jargon, such as what is his image, or what's the image of that person in society today. That's not the kind of image that we're talking about. And I think that you understand that these are images that come from the mind in terms of a projection of either experiences of an intellectual or an emotional or sensuous type, and a drive that we have within us to put that experience in some kind of image form. Now, a lot of people think imagination. Well, I don't have any imagination. I have a brother-in-law who said, well, I think, was it his wife who said, you know, I don't think he's ever going to become a Christian because he doesn't have any imagination. Well, no, you know, that I laughed at first, and I think it is kind of a good statement. But you stop and ask yourself, how far would you get with the Christian faith or reading either the Old Testament or the New Testament if you did not have an imagination? And is it possible for a person to be completely without an imagination? I could also go into a long discourse on what happens about the first and second years in school, along with kindergarten, to most children's imagination, which they are really endowed with in full measure by their Creator. And the Lord really, I think, intends all of us to have imagination as a gift. What we do to the imagination when we are when we start organizing it in terms of the first few years in school is sometimes a rather tragic thing. However, it does not mean that imagination cannot be recultivated. So don't use it as an excuse that you had a terrible childhood and a very bad group of teachers who simply stifled all your imagination, and therefore you can't even read, well, you can't read the Bible, of course, because you can't project yourself that far, and you really can't understand any other literature either. Well, then let me tell you that you're not likely to be able to understand history or science, because all of these fields, no matter what way you approach them, do require that you use the imagination. In fact, it would be very difficult for you to speak if you didn't use your imagination. We often think about imagination as being it's the hallmark of poetry. Usually we think of it as being the quality that produces poetry and poetic style. Sometimes we go so far finally to think of it in terms of prose, particularly when it is involved in story. But we don't realize that half of the work of the imagination is involved in the actual production of our language. In other words, the first word that somebody was going to use to describe an emotion or an experience involved the use of the imagination. It was the sense of loneliness that person perhaps had in not being able to share what he had experienced with someone else, and he had to figure out something to use that would take this experience beyond his own life and into the other person's. Now, when you converse with another person, do you use an imagination or not? Well, of course, I know some people don't, because they're very busy, spouting their own ideas, and they don't really care whether anybody is catching them or not. And that is a profound lack of imagination. Because when you don't empathize and project into other people's responses, you're not using your imagination. It doesn't mean that you don't have it, but you're not using it. And probably because it's very handy not to use it. Because it's true that you get a good sense of having things well in order if you never have to deal with the response of the other person when you're speaking to them. Well, all these things are involved in imagination. Relationships with other people, the speech that we use, are exploring into whatever field of knowledge we're in or going into, all involves the imagination. I read a very good quotation from Einstein on the importance of mystery. And he was thinking of it in terms of wonder and the use of the imagination. And he said that people who lose their sense of mystery about life are of all people the most desolate. Because when we lose our sense of wonder, then we have become barren. And I hope I put it down here, I meant to. He calls it, I think it's almost like, and it reminds me of something out of Shakespeare or even Milton. I think Milton would use fair in the same way. The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. Now, the imagination is very often involved in the mysterious, in the mystery that is involved in all of life. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and science. He who knows it not and can no longer feel wonder, no longer feel amazement, is as good as dead, a snuffed out candle. And I remember reading a neat thing by Arthur Kessler on the way in which, my memory is getting progressively worse, so I'm going to have to use a great deal of imagination the older I get, I think. But Arthur Kessler had a very, very interesting statement on the way in which scientific discoveries are made. Very often, he said, all the facts are in, but they don't come together. They're just, you know, sort of flying around, not detached, not attached. They're all detached. And he said, this one man who was really pondering this one discovery, which was a very, very famous one, and I have a feeling it has, I think it's either Eddington or Jeans, and it has something that was on the making of the universe. I can't remember which one it was, alas. But at any rate, he was sitting beside the fire and kind of dreaming and thinking about what he had been working over. And as he sat there and let his imagination play with all these facts that he had, they began to come together in a remarkable way. And they began to fit. And the discovery of something, which I can't recall the exact thing, but the discovery of that occurred as a result of the imagination working with these facts. Now, the reason I brought that up is something that Tolkien brings out very clearly in a very, well, I was good, it's not so delightful. It's a long essay, a lecture that he gave on fairy stories. And those of you who think, oh, wow, nice, I think I'll read a little essay on fairy stories. Well, don't start out that way. If you want to read it, just plan on spending some time on it, because he's not dealing with, you know, who married what and how, and how did the frog prince come into the picture and all that sort of thing, and how nice it is that we have such things. He really grapples with a great many extremely important issues in the making of fairy stories and why we have them. But in this essay, he brings out the I think very important statement that fantasy or imagination does not develop where people are not concerned about truth and facts, where they are not concerned about really knowing objectively what the world is made of and the whys and the wherefores of things that are around us. So often we think of imagination as being sort of an excuse or a substitute for the for tough, hard work, and we say, well, you know, she doesn't do very well in mathematics, but she's very imaginative. Well, that's not a corollary, because people who study very hard and sometimes work very hard in science and in math, can also be very imaginative, as I mentioned before, in connection with this one scientist, and also in Einstein's quotation. So it is not in a society that is dealing with kind of a frivolity of, let's just pretend we're someplace else because we can't deal with life the way it is. This is not what imagination is involved in. Imagination is involved in dealing with the world as it is, facts as they are, and out of that you put together a whole new kind of interpretation of the universe or of an immediate situation. Sometimes it involves something huge, and sometimes it's something very immediate and very close to you. Tolkien uses four different categories when he describes the way in which fairy tales are developed, and I'm going to just mention them because how many of you have read any fairy tales recently? Besides to your grandchildren, that is. Some people have read them, and I know some of those people don't have any grandchildren. The interesting thing about some fairy tales is that they are not meant for children. They really were meant for adults. Now, those of you who have read the Narnia series, the C.S. Lewis books, know that those were dedicated to his godchildren. But they are really quite interesting to a lot of adults. I've told a number of people. I know when my father, who was a man of about 82 or 3 at the time, was listening to our oldest daughter reading the Narnia books to her 5 younger brothers and sisters, my father could not figure out why they were sitting so still, even Andy, who was only 2 at the time. And he decided that along with pulling on his pipe, he ought to be checking up on what his grandchildren were reading. And so he came over and got the book when the children went to bed. And interestingly enough, he didn't give it up until he was through with it, and he read all the rest of them. And he said to me, that's about as good theology as you could get anywhere. He said, I don't see anything wrong with it at all. And I said, well, why? Should there be something wrong with it? Well, he thought anything that was interesting to children that much, well, it wouldn't be wrong, but, he kind of wondered that it would have any real meaning. Well, I think this is the problem we have with fairy tales. We think that because they have the whole idea of happy endings, and we know that, life doesn't have a happy ending. Everybody knows that life is real, life is earnest. But, the grave is not its goal. And one thing about fairy tales is that if we could understand them rightly, many of them would give us the realization that the very fact that the grave is not the goal of life also implies the fact that there is the possibility of a happy ending. And the Narnia stories, I would strongly recommend to all of you who are over 50, because I know that those of you who are under 50 are already, I suppose you are all addicts, or at least have been exposed to them. But those of you who are over 50 who have not read them, I really feel that it's your duty to at least read one. And if you don't like it, you don't have to read anymore. Nobody's going to require it. But I would suggest it because it is a very good way to cultivate your imagination. Now, Tolkien, in his discussion of the fairy tale, which I'm taking as sort of a structure for imagination just for the time being, uses the term fantasy because he feels that we need to think of something other than image making, probably because of all our problems with, the image makers and what is your image and so on. And so he uses the term fantasy, not with the idea of, you're fantasizing, which is what another word that gets, you know, so that you take the meaning out of the original word, and then what you have left, you have to make up another one. But he hadn't run into that problem of fantasizing, apparently. And he uses the term fantasy with the idea that this is a way in which the imagination can really work. Now, when the imagination is at work in making a story, now we're not talking about it in terms of language or science or history or any of these other things, but when fantasy or imagination is at work making a story, the problem is to get you out of this particular spot that you're in into another world. Now, if the person who is writing that story is able to do a really good job, he is able to get you into this, what he calls a secondary world. He's able to get you into this secondary world so that you actually are living in it as if it were this one. Now you say, well, yeah, but what's the point of that? Well, you know, it's amazing. But those of you who have read the Tolkien books and know what an adult fairy tale is like can vouch for the truth of this statement, that although you know that the world of the hobbits and the strange pilgrimage that these hobbits go on in order to fight the evil that is in their world, that although in your head, you know that this is a story. You read that whole thing as if you were involved in the same kind of trip that Frodo and Samwise are on. And you get just as frightened by the black riders, and you get just as disturbed by going through these terrific caverns as if it were the world in which you live, as if you were walking through a dark wood and felt that you were being attacked by nobody would know the names of the things that you might be attacked by. Now, I might say that when somebody like Ernie Zorb, who is, you know, pretty much at one with the woods and the fish and the land around us, can be so completely won over to something as he was won over by the Tolkien books, I would say that almost anybody would dare to take that leap. In fact, he informed me that he thought that the woods around Holden Lake was probably full of ants. Now, those of you who've read the Tolkien books know that the ants are the spirits of these really old trees, and they really, they are frightening, and yet they are protective too. But they are part of the whole mythology of the Fellowship of the Ring. Now, when Tolkien is talking about this fantasy world that allows you, if what is done right, allows you to get into this secondary world so that you really think it's actually happening to you, that is a successful story. Now, this also happens in any good writing. Any good literature does this. The reason I'm using the Tolkien books here is because I know that is a common book that is available to the people in lifestyle. Those of you who are older and who were acquainted with other books in your growing up period and to books to which you return many times know the same kind of experience if you've allowed yourself to. But I have a hunch that some of you have let that kind of dry up. Because, you know, we get awfully busy looking at women's magazines or Field and Stream or the newspaper and the television and all that sort of thing. And pretty soon, the image-making possibilities up here begin to just kind of atrophy, because we don't have to have them. Goodness sakes, you can look at them on television. What do you need to make images for? You don't have to make any fantasy in your head when you can see it already prefabricated. And so it takes a little work to cultivate. And I've noticed that having Dr. Morfitt read Paradise Lost has really fed my imagination in a way that I had forgotten about completely. Just tremendous. And yet, you know, it's as he mentioned last night, it takes a little work. It's a lot easier to just sit and converse about nothing than to sit and listen to something that's really packed with image-making possibilities. Now, this whole approach of the fantasy world and this business of moving into a secondary world has a real meaning for you, not just in terms of knowing what, you know, what's it all about. I mean, why get involved in it? The word for tale in one of the old English terms was spell. And spell is exactly what a good story puts on you. It puts a spell on you. And that's what happens to you. So you can see that that whoever it is that's creating this has something to do for good or ill as far as you're concerned. If you're going to be able if that spell is going to be something that makes of you a deeper, richer person or not. It behooves you to look and see what you are reading. And as C.S. Lewis said about his own life, it's also a very good thing for a young man who is an unbeliever to be careful of what he reads, because one never knows. That's what happened to him. He ran into George MacDonald's writings in a bookstore and was absolutely taken off his feet and eventually became a Christian. So he said, be careful what you read. The problem of once you think in terms of fantasy and the imagination, you also have to think in terms of what that kind of writing does for you and what this whole world of the imagination does for you. It has a very specific meaning in terms of recovery. A recovery of joy and enjoyment, of freshness and delight in life. You know this old, stupid old thing, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, it doesn't just breed contempt, but I think it sometimes breeds boredom. You know, once you think you own something, and this is true of family, certainly, people you know very well sometimes, you can enjoy them. You know, you own them. So why, it's just like books. I've got shelves of books, and I can hardly wait till I buy the next one. And then it sits. You know, well, if I don't open that book and read it, I'm just like an alcoholic. I've got another bottle on my shelf. I suppose the alcoholic should be glad that he's not opening up and drinking it and getting drunk. But it is true that if you're going to possess a lot of things and never enjoy them, what good are they to you? And this happens to so many things in our life and so many events in our life and people in our life. We just get accustomed to them, and we stop enjoying them, and we lose our sense of wonder. And when we lose our sense of wonder, you know what Einstein said? I wasn't the Lord, it was Einstein. He said that, you lose your sense of wonder, you really have become a snuffed out candle. And not to the extent that I wrote my thesis on it, but Tom Dunn is the man that I wrote on. And one of the beautiful little statements that he made when all divinity is love and wonder, that really your faith and your relationship to God is sometimes can be epitomized or capitalized in love and wonder. So if you've lost your sense of amazement, look out. Because it's, you know, dangerous. So you need this sense of recovery in terms of the imagination and in terms of the kind of reading or story that you're going to be involved in order to keep that imagination going. It's a recovery of that sense of wonder. It's a recovery of joy. It's a recovery of freshness with the things that are sort of taken for granted. And you know, it's true that when you read something that just talks about very normal things, sometimes it's just like, very often can't snap my fingers right, and I do. Always when I want to make a point, they fall to pieces. I should practice before I come. But very often, when the poem may be about very ordinary things, and that will just capture you again to a new delight in that the things that you have taken for granted for maybe days and days or months or years. And that's another gift that the imagination has. It helps you recover that sense of joy in living and the taste of life. I wanted to read, just in connection with this, this one isn't the one I was thinking. This one particular poem isn't the one I was thinking of, except that it does give you a tremendous sense of mystery and excitement about life and about the way in which one man can make life exciting even when you least expect it. But the poem I was thinking of was that neat song that you know that the hobbits sing about. It just does pick up the wood and the fire and the stone and the fellowship around the fire and the feeling of people and the love of the homecoming and the sound of the footsteps at the door. All those things, and they can mean 100 things, different things to different people, but it does restore and recover for you a sense of the reality of just individual experiences that you touch and smell and taste most of the time every day and forget about it. The other two sides of the imagination and the way in which it is a part of us as far as literature is concerned are escape and consolation. Now, Tolkien has a very good little development on that, because he uses the idea of escape literature. You know, I always used to think, escape literature, that was terrible. And, you know, you shouldn't, because I was a very moral, upright girl that thought you shouldn't escape from reality. And I'm sure you were too, moral, upright girls and boys, all of you, thought you shouldn't escape from reality and you should only read, you know, things that were right here in front of you and do your lessons and, you know, don't take any time. I know you did read fairy tales and novels just as I did, but, you know, you always had the feeling that it was escapist, and you all sort of apologized to yourself, well, you know, have to get away from it all once in a while. Tolkien has a very great little statement on that about in terms of escapist literature, and he says, after all, what's so real about a motor car and paved roads and traffic lights? Is it, you know, are they more real than dragons and horses and grass and people that you talk to? He said, is it so terrible to want to go beyond the confines of your own immediate existence and maybe explore the sea or fly in the sky? Or maybe haven't you ever wished that you could talk to the trees or the animals? And if a book does it for you, you know, what kind of escape is that? It simply broadens your horizon. And if you think the real world is all involved in certain physical attributes of it, like radios and TVs and traffic lights, then you better think over a little bit, what does your reality consist in? There weren't any such things in the Gospels either, you know. And it's amazing how much of the life of Jesus was involved in walking about in places that were not the heavily trafficked areas. And they weren't the big centers like Rome, but it was in just a funny little old place, almost as out of the way as Holden Village. And think about that too when you think about Holden, because I thought about that this afternoon when I was thinking about this talk, and I thought, you know, why do we think that Holden isn't real? Business isn't to answer the questions. I just asked you. But Tolkien says very specifically that for many people, if the life that they're in is a real prison, I mean, they may be imprisoned with sorrow and misery and they hate what they're in, their only way of escape sometimes is a book. Well, you can say, yes, but, you know, that doesn't improve a situation. Well, would sitting around and, you know, chewing his fingernails help any? You know, sometimes if you get outside of something long enough, when you come back to it, you've got a bit of fresh air to breathe, and you can deal with what's there. And even if you can, it was worth it to be away. I know I sound like a preacher, but, you know, I have this terrible feeling that you're not going to be able to hear me or you're going to go to sleep. So I have to, you know, project over this huge black shell here. And so if I sound like that, I'm really pounding the pulpit. I don't have a pulpit, so I have to make a pulpit noise out of my voice. But this is part of the reason that a lot of people think about imagination as being an escapist complex. You know, if you use your imagination too much, well, you know, it's like daydreaming. That's bad. Well, you know, daydreams are really quite important. If you're going to think about what you're going to do with your life or where you want to go, sometimes daydreams are the only way in which your life has a chance to project itself, because you would never dare to talk to somebody about the things you really would like to be capable of doing, because they would say, oh yeah, I know, you're gonna do real well. Why don't you get your arithmetic done? Or something else. So the problem of escape literature is not always negative. I would say that that if the only literature you ever read, and I use literature in the sense of anything that is printed, which is really not the correct interpretation of literature, I grant. But, you know, if you're just on the stage where sort of a little bit beyond the comic book, you know, I can't say that's all that good to encourage that kind of escape. And yet, I'd rather have you read the comic books than have people sitting and looking at television all the time. At least you are looking at print. And maybe sometime it's going to move into something different. And I think that many teachers in remedial reading are discovering that if they can just get the youngsters to get used to reading of the printed page and feeling like, you know, there might be something interesting there, it isn't all dull, that gradually as they get some proficiency in it, they may move into something else. It certainly isn't going to happen by looking at pictures that are moving on a screen. And then you have the the sense that we all have an inside of us of somehow feeling that we're going to escape from death. That's the great escape that we look for when we look at literature or the imagination. I mean, I don't care whether you're young or old. Of course, when you're young, you think it never can happen to you. And when you're old, you don't think it's going to happen either because everybody else dies, but you don't. I know my father felt that he wasn't ever going to die. He was 90 when he died finally. But he was so lonesome because all his best friends were gone. And he really was like, you know, the last leaf on the tree. And but inside of us, we sort of have a feeling that, you know, we know we're not going to escape it, and yet, no, it's never really going to happen. Well, it really doesn't ever happen, because when it happens, we don't know it. Isn't that true? So, in a sense, it's not so strange that we have that kind of a feeling about that great escape. But it is also true that when we read, some of the things that we read in the realm of imaginative literature can give us a very different attitude toward that final point of no return, in which we really move into another world. And I think that one of the great things about the endings of really good fairy tales and good stories of that nature is that they end with a sense of real joy. Not, you know, not that kind of sort of Hollywood kind of thing that some of us grew up on. I don't think that some people here weren't ever exposed to it, and I think some of the younger people probably have never had too much of that, because I don't think that's been the style of the movie so much lately. They've been more more turbulent and violent than this sort of romance that we had, which was sort of sugary. And I don't know which I would choose, but they're in a really good imaginative writing. You get a true sense of joy, real joy. And that is really should be the meaning of that final movement into another world. That the real ending of our life is the beginning of a greater joy. And good imaginative writing can do that for you. It can when it's in the realm of the fairy tale, especially. And so when you finish a book of that nature or a story of that nature, you are near to tears. You really are. You really feel gripped by something, and yet it's the kind of tears that are caught up in a sense of joy at the same time. Now that's a strange combination, but it's true. It's the kind of thing that I still feel when I read the ending of The Last Battle in the Narnia books. And I think that it's I never tire of reading them out loud, and I never tire of reading them to myself. I mean, I don't go over them piece by piece by any means every year, but they are not dull, and they do have that quickening of the emotion, so that you get a real sense of the analogy and the likeness that there is in this situation to what you have a feeling will be the way life will end and begin. And I want to read just a little epilogue that Tolkien uses as an explanation of this joy that he talks about, because it explains, I think, very clearly what he means. The peculiar quality of the joy in successful fantasy can thus be explained as a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality or truth. It is not only a consolation or comfort for the sorrow of this world, but a satisfaction And in answer to that question, is it true, which, you know, is what a lot of children ask, when, you know, when you tell them, I don't know if it's what their children reads. Does anybody tell kids fairy tales anymore? I know, you know, we always said, either is it true or is it good, is that person going to be killed, is he going to live or not, you know, I mean, there were, these were the problems. And is it true was quite important. Then he says, in the fairy tale, he believes that there is what he calls a eucatastrophe. In other words, there's a catastrophe at the end that is a good one, a happy one, a fine one, that turns everything upside down and puts it back into place again in a really wonderful way. In this eucatastrophe, we see in a brief vision that the answer may be greater. It may be a far-off gleam or echo of Evangelium in the real world. The use of this word gives a hint of my epilogue. It is a serious and dangerous matter, and that's why it's, you know, this is an important thing to be talking about. This is not just, fairy tales are not just something to ha-ha about, or, you know, well, that's nice, I must give my nephew or my grandchild or my little sister or brother a good book of fairy tales because it would be good for their imaginations. It is a serious and dangerous matter. I am a Christian, and so at least should not be suspected of willful irreverence. Knowing my own ignorance and dullness, it is perhaps presumptuous of me to touch upon such a theme. But if by grace what I say has in any respect any validity, it is of course only one facet of a truth incalculably rich, finite only because the capacity of man for whom this was done is finite. And then he goes on to explain what the gospel does for man, that the birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. It has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. In other words, what every story must have is not just something that you can project yourself into, but that it has to ring true. It has to have reality in it if you're going to really feel that you can give yourself to it. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. For the art of it has a supremely convincing tone of primary art, that is, of creation. To reject it leads either to sadness or to wrath. And then he has this great thing to say. He says, you know, maybe, what if some people say, well, what if it turned out not to be true? Well, he says, it's not likely. But he said the joy would have exactly the same quality, if not the same degree, as the joy which the turn in a fairy story gives. Such joy has the very taste of primary truth. Otherwise, its name would not be joy. It looks forward or backward. The direction in this regard is unimportant to the great eucatastrophe. The Christian joy, the Gloria, is of the same kind. But it is preeminently, infinitely, if our capacity were not finite, high and joyous, because the story is supreme and it is true. Art has been verified. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. And then he goes on and explains that, you know, we are going to have our imagination to deal with all the time as we live. And we're going to be using it as part of our life and as part of as one of the great gifts that God has given us. And he says, the Christian has still to work with mind as well as body to suffer, hope, and die. It's not just that the Evangelium has not abrogated legends, but it has hallowed them, especially the happy ending. And now the Christian may perceive that all his bents and faculties have a purpose which can be redeemed. So great is the bounty with which he has been treated that he may now perhaps fairly dare to guess that in fantasy he may actually assist in the effoliation and multiple enrichment of creation. All tales may come true, and yet at the last, redeemed, they may be as like and as unlike the forms that we give them as man, finally redeemed, will be like and unlike the fallen person that we know. And that is the conclusion of this particular lecture on the imagination. I was trying to find a quote from Paradise Lost in which Milton really takes the imagination through. He really went to town on it. And the other night when Dr. Morfitt was reading it, he very, very tactfully avoided that part. All he did was talk about reason. And then the whole next series of lines is sort of an anathema against the imagination. But I never find any quotations when I want them, and when I don't need it, I'll suppose it'll sit right up and look at me. But that particular quotation would have been a good one to read simply because it clarifies the difference between imagination and fantasy and a kind of a sloppy kind of fancifulness, which is an excuse for not thinking or for not really going after facts in the first place, and so then you dream up something to take its place. Certainly the principle of the world of fantasy and the understanding of the imagination in the way in which the people who belong to this particular group of writers called the Inklings, the way in which they understood it was in no way a substitute for intellectual accuracy or diligence. All the people who were in that group, and they happened to be all men, but they were all men who had taken their degrees, most of them at Cambridge or Oxford. They knew their Greek and Latin and sometimes Hebrew. They were people who had special studies in some particular field of of English literature and were anything but casual scholars. They were extremely erudite and informed people, and they were the kind of writers and professors who were completely at home in the world of historical scholarship as well as contemporary scholarship. And they were, if anything, almost extra scholarly, you might say, rather than not. When people use the term imagination as a kind of a smear word, I often think of it in terms of the way in which some people use piety when they think of piety as an excuse for not facing intellectual problems and not doing your intellectual homework in terms of your Christian life. And I think that's the way a lot of people think about the imagination, that they think of it in terms of as a substitute for the actual hard work that's involved in the whole matter of scholarship and thinking. This type of this understanding of the word imagination is certainly not applicable to the Inklings, who were, as I say, a very a very learned and very scholarly group of people, and perhaps that's why what they write has a lasting kind of influence, and is not, when they let their imaginations go, they don't, it's not just, you know, spinning off a whole lot of cloudy dreams, but is actually based on a lot of content, so that there is stuff there to deal with, not just something that somebody has just dreamed up themselves. In connection with this, I'd like to throw out the word discovery rather than creativity in connection with the imagination. Creativity is a big word right now, and people are always talking about being creative, and you know, let's, you know, get a little more creative in our liturgy, creative in our worship, creative in our Christianity, creative in our scholarship, education. The man who probably more than any other could be known as the godfather of this particular group of people is a man named George MacDonald. I suppose nobody here has read At the Back of the North Wind, or have you?
Well, that's good. I'm glad somebody had. Anybody else read it? Good.
Well, the little light princess in the back of the North Wind, and the princess and Curdy, and then a whole lot of others that nobody knows much about, were books by a preacher and a writer and an actor, as well as a father of about 9-10 children, who lived in England in the last century. His name was George MacDonald, and it was he who wrote a book on the imagination that actually stirred C.S. Lewis enough to make him begin to think about Christianity as a viable option. He'd been an atheist all of his student life, and he decided that after reading this book, it began to light a few fires in his brain, and he began to wonder if maybe he should explore some of the possibilities of this faith that he had dropped down the drain quite a long time back. George MacDonald, in this essay on the imagination, which is written in typical Victorian style and really, you know, kind of very ponderous and heavy, has a very nice little introduction, though, that I think I'm going to read, just because it, I think some people, it isn't all that far away from what a lot of people think about in education. He refers to the problem of being educated as being a solved problem once you're through with it. That when you've been educated, then you should be at peace. Now, those of you who remember all the big things we had with peace of mind and sort of feeling like that was the end of all things, was to have peace of mind, realize that we're not all that far from this particular angle on education or the way in which to see life. And so it's not so much just Victorian. It certainly is, I think, applies to us as well. He said, repose is not the end of education. Its end is a noble unrest, an ever-renewed awaking from the dead, a ceaseless questioning of the past for the interpretation of the future, an urging on of the motions of life, which had better far be accelerated into fever than retarded into lethargy. When you think of how many people, at least in my day, and I don't know how you people feel about it, young or old, but a diploma meant, that was, you know, then it was over. And you started out on your real life. And this is, I'm afraid, the way a lot of people feel about their confirmation as well. That all their learning is over, and now they can vote in the church, and that's it. The understanding that that imagination, as George MacDonald goes on to say in this essay, is the fire that has to be fed continually throughout your life in order to keep that life awake and searching and alive. If we let this imagination die out, then we're going to be, as we said yesterday, a snuffed out candle. And MacDonald goes on to develop the way in which your whole life, from the time that you're beginning to be educated, ought to be a nurturing of this power of the imagination, and that it also should be something that is cultivated and developed. And we mentioned the other day the importance of nurturing the imagination and feeding it. And you don't feed it by just reading a lot of tripe, you might say, or comic books, although it helps us, I still think, to at least look at print once in a while. But you do feed it by putting something into it that has actual stuff to it. And this is the kind of imaginative writing that this group of English writers did, and a few of them, I think there may be one or two of them still alive, but the ones who really did the most in the realm of really exciting imaginative writing, I'm afraid, are all dead. But as far as we're concerned, they're not dead, because the books that they wrote are so alive that when you read them, you are not dealing with something that's sort of a bygone plot or a bygone event, but you're reading something that grabs you right where you are, and I don't care how many times you read them, they keep on grabbing you, they keep on getting to you. The people that were in the group known as the Inklings were a number that varied from time to time, but those that we know the best, and in the period in which is known as the Golden Decade, are Charles Williams, C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, Owen Barfield, and Warren Lewis, who was C.S. Lewis's brother. These people are all people who have published at least something that we can still get hold of. There were several other people who wrote, but most of their stuff was in the form of essays or criticisms that we don't, at least in this country, are not very well known. I would say that the quality that all these people have, and the reason that I mentioned that I don't think that the word creativity is what I would use in connection with them, is a quality of discovery. They all give you the feeling that they are leading you into a world, a new world of in which you are going to discover something for yourself, something that they've discovered and something that you are going to discover, and that perhaps you'll mutually discover more of as you go along and read farther along into the books that they've written. I like the word discovery because it isn't quite so, you don't feel like it's quite such a self-praising kind of word as creative. You can say that you're discovering something or you're exploring something with a little more humility than to say, well, I'm a really creative person. But you say you're and you can't really say you're a creator, because we know basically there is one creator, and that's God, and we are related in a very derivative way from Him. And where we do have similar relationships in our expression to His, perhaps would be in terms of the imagination and in that field. But we aren't really creators. We are discoverers of the truth that he has, and he has it in all sorts of interesting and veiled places. They're not right out in the open, and they're not you know plain as the nose on your face or a theorem in a geometry book. They do come at you in a lot of sort of oblique ways, and this is the quality that the Inklings have in the way in which they write. It interested me a great deal that Lawrence Vanderpost, who's one of my favorite writers about South Africa, he was born there, and he has had to leave South Africa because of his very outspoken position on the apartheid. But he has written many books on the life of the very primitive or original people, you might say, of the South African countries. He has a great little book called The Lost World of the Kalahari. And in that book and in some of the others, he talks about the life of those people and the fact that when they are thinking about their life as a people, or when they're beginning to write a song, or even when they're getting ready to go into battle, they wait for direction, and they say the words that they use are, "We have a dream dreaming us. We have a dream dreaming us." It's not that they're dreaming, but a dream is dreaming them. Now, that's quite a different feeling from the feeling that somehow you've got a hold of things and you're the one that's sort of in charge and you're in control. They had very much the feeling that when they were getting ready to write or sing, that they waited for an inspiration, and that came through this feeling of a dream dreaming them. One of the new things that I discovered about C.S. Lewis in the new biography that has just come out and that we just got from the Burtonses from Oxford is the fact that a lot of the beginnings, particularly of the Narnia books, but some of the other books as well that he wrote, came from dreams that he had. He was a man who had a great many nightmares. Now, those of you who have nightmares, don't give up, because you may find out that it's a real way in which you're going to startle the world with some really good writing. You will have to do a little work on the style side and do a little studying as well, so that you can get your tools in shape. But don't give up on the dream life, because the Narnia books definitely began to come to him in little spurts. He recalls a specific dream about a lion and about a fawn. Mr. Tumnus, those of you who have read Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, remember this funny little fawn, and he was running around with a little satchel in his hand, and Lewis said it was really a most amusing dream. It didn't have any end to it, but then what dreams do? You know, they're always cut off and rather fragmentary. The thing is that a person who's a real discoverer will hang on to that and will remember it and will use it later, so that other people can be a part of that dream in a larger form, and that's what Lewis did. I don't know whether Tolkien was a dreamer or not, but he must have had some dreams to get that Lord of the Rings going, because I don't think that's anything that you could have possibly gotten all by yourselves. Charles Williams books, for those of you who are not acquainted with them, are, I don't really know a word to describe them exactly, because they are different totally from anything that I've ever read in my life. They they combine a dynamic and radical Christian message with an almost surrealistic situation. The kind of situation in which it occurs is a really strange one and way off from any kind of what we understand as reality. And you're going to be reading at least one of them this year, so it's worth, if you want to read something around October, during around Halloween, it might be good to read All Hallows Eve. John, didn't you just finish that, John? I remember 2 years ago when the lifestyle people were reading, we read, we started Charles Williams in the fall, and some of them read that, and one girl was convinced there was a ghost in Koinonia, and she had quite a few other people convinced of it too. Well, you know, Charles Williams is not all that, he's not all that, aren't all that sure that, that our general opinions on everything are particularly to be depended upon. You know, you can't really feel, you don't really feel how do we know? All the answers aren't in, and the Lord has certainly not said that everything is, you know, is going to be available for us right away. And therefore, you have to hold some things in abeyance and wait until you discover them. And what the Lord teaches you may be something quite different from what you expected. And this is what Lewis found out all through his life, that the more that he read, the more that he wrote, the more that God taught him and led him into new discoveries. And this is what I think is exciting about all of these people and the way in which they wrote. The reason that they call themselves, by the way, the Inklings was because they, for one thing, an inkling is a person who has you have an inkling of what somebody else thinks about. You know, I've got an inkling of what you mean, but, you know, you've got a suggestion. Well, they were all sort of one group in terms of, they had a similar kind of suggestiveness to each other. And besides that, they also had a strong feeling for ink, that ink was their media, their medium of all different sorts. And therefore, when they got together, these people who were involved in writing, they had a great time discussing what they were writing, as well as things that were not going to be written right then, but things that were interesting them, such as life after death and what that would be likely to be, whether animals went to heaven, what was going to happen to them, how was the last judgment going to take place. They were all quite orthodox. They weren't just off on some, you know, cloud nine or some odd kind of religious movement. They were members, most of them, either of the Anglican Church or of the Roman Catholic Church. Tolkien was a Roman Catholic, and I think the rest of them were all, I think they were, the rest of them were Anglicans. But they were all Christians, except for Owen Barfield, who was rather a offbeat, I think he was kind of a Unitarian, but he did enjoy being part of the group, and who knows how much the influence of what they said and what they wrote and how they argued and discussed with him, what kind of effect it has had on him, because I don't think he's dead yet. He's still got a chance. The life that these people led together was not, they were not all part of the same family group by any means. They had to come and meet each other every week in order to in order to have a chance to discuss and read what they were writing and have critiques made of the things that they were doing. And all the time that they were doing this, they were getting both negative and positive criticisms. Now, Tolkien, when C.S. Lewis read the first of the Narnia books, started reading it, and then gave the copy, the manuscript, to Tolkien. Tolkien said, "It won't do. It won't do at all. It's terrible. It's frightful." And if Lewis had taken him as his one guide, we would never have had them. But you see, they didn't have that kind of a feeling of absolutism over against each other. It was an open discussion, and they threw the ideas back and forth, and they criticized, and they discussed. And still, it was always up to the one individual person to decide what he was going to do with it. And as you know, Lewis did not follow Tolkien's guidance. He did follow the guidance of a young student of his to whom he read these manuscripts quite a bit, and who finally wrote his biography, Roger Lanson Green. And this man did a great deal to put the Narnia books, give them a little bit more of a kind of style that makes them available to people who are not just English or Irish, but also can come across to people in the United States. It's interesting, though, that I was thinking about it when we were in Denmark and Norway this summer. There are a few translations of the C.S. Lewis books in Danish. I think they have the Ring books in Danish, but generally speaking, I don't think that there's anybody in the Scandinavias or in Germany who has written anything like these stories that have come out of this particular group of people. Now, I'm wondering if it's because of the nature of the beast, if we're the kind of people, the Germanic and Scandinavian tribes are sort of heavy and can't, you know, get off the ground on things like that, or if we haven't had enough of a revival so that we don't have the kind of Christian imagination yet in those countries to really put something like this on paper. Now, perhaps maybe some of you have heard of something written in either Scandinavian literature or in German literature that is like that, but most of the literature that is that is written in terms of a kind of with a Christian surrounding to it has a kind of a sad, dark feeling to it. There is very little of the feeling of being surprised by joy unless you are reading sermons. And maybe it's up to somebody to start. I don't know. We have to wait and see. But I really felt badly that nobody that there were no books like this, apparently, in the European scene, particularly in the Lutheran countries. And I felt that they'd lost a great deal, because I know that the American Christianity has gained a great deal because of the fact that we do have the work of these very exciting and interesting men. How many of you people in Lifestyle have read C.S. Lewis? Have read any of his fiction? Now, the Narnia books or the science fiction? Have you read the science fiction, any of you? Irlandra or On the Silent Planet? The Great Divorce? How about the rest of you? Have you read any of them? None of them? Have you read the science fiction? No. Have you? The On the Silent Planet? Mm-hmm. How about you people? Okay, well, no, it's nothing. Rue, have you? Yeah. Well, that's the that actually The Great Divorce is a combination of fiction and theology. It's a really beautiful combination, and it's a book that I think is on your list, isn't it, for the year? I don't think that the rest of them are on your book list, but I would suggest that when you have the time, when you get through with Where the Wasteland Ends, that you do read one of Lewis's novels, because they do catch you off guard enough so that you get a new perspective of Christianity, simply because he doesn't use any Christian terms. He doesn't talk to you about he's not pushing any kind of a message in terms of, you know, well, I've got to see to it that this gets across and this gets across and this gets across. He thinks clearly enough so that what he's writing does come across without a conscious attempt to infiltrate you or indoctrinate you. He has a very neat little statement that he makes someplace where he says, well, you know, sometimes you're really able to get past the dragons at the door. And he means by that the dragons that keep all of us from being open to the gospel. And the way in which you have to do it is in this rather snide way of writing literature that is entertaining, pure and simple. It's not dull. It's not stuff that you have to read because you read because you have to. But it really reads so that you want to read it because you want to find out what's happening. And it's not written with the idea that you have to. You don't have to read it with that idea in mind. In fact, if you start reading it and it bores you, I would drop it for a while, because you may not be ready for it yet. You know, there is such a thing as being mature enough to read some things, and some things are, and then sometimes you're not mature in a particular direction. You may be ready for something in another field. And certainly that's true of the Charles Williams books, because they require a kind of concentration that almost is like a very difficult puzzle, because you have to keep track of so much that's going on and try to keep figuring out who's doing what and who's the wrong one and who's the right one. There's no very clear line saying these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. You really are confronted with a mixture. And it shouldn't surprise us that much, because I wonder how many people in this room are so completely sure how good or how bad the person next to him is. Or the person who's sitting in your own chair. One interesting thing that C.S. Lewis wrote, a very good little statement about that very thing, when he was writing on the problem of evil. And people asked him, oh, you must have done a great deal of studying on moral theology and on the whole involvement of asceticism and the whole concept of sin. And he let them go on and on. And finally he said, well, you know, really, I have not had to do much studying, because he said, I have a very good first-hand experiment right here. He said, I just used my own heart. He said, that's about all anybody needs to do in order to really find out what sin is and what evil is. And I would say that as I say, you may not be ready for some of these yet, because some of you may be very smart in school, but you haven't gotten very smart down inside. And this is something that you do learn when you read C.S. Lewis, that he gets at you from the inside, and you begin to look out with different eyes, both at yourself and at the world. The reason I asked how many people had read his books was because I was interested in finding out if I should go through them a little bit and give you some ideas about them, so that you get a feeling of where you're at when you read them. The books are in, I would say, three categories. I'll start with the Lewis books, because they are the ones that are the most popular and certainly the most I would say generally available. The Tolkien books are mainly just in that one series of The Lord of the Rings. The Charles Williams books are relatively difficult to get. We had to order them from Oxford, from Blackwell's, and I'm sure that they will be. He will become a rage, just like Lewis is now and Tolkien has been, because until we find somebody in the United States that can come up to that, we'll have to depend on the English writers to supply us with this kind of excitement, I guess, in our educational centers. The interesting thing is, with all our church colleges, I should think we'd begin to produce it, but they don't have all that many church colleges in England. But sometimes when you are too protective of people, sometimes you don't get the same kind of developments. The Lewis books are in groups of science fiction, children's stories, and the straight theology. I'm just going to mention a little bit about the fiction, because we're talking mainly about the imagination. And although Lewis writes his books on theology are imaginative, because he uses an imaginative style, and he projects, as we talked about 2 days ago, in order to use the imagination, you've got to project into what other people need and what other people are thinking and what kind of people other people are, as well as the kind of person you are, in order to write a good theological book that is, it's going to be popular. And this is true of all of his theological works. But for straight imagination, I think it's far more interesting to, for our point right now, is to discuss his novels, his science fiction, and his children's novel, or his children's stories. When he was talking about his children's stories, he was quite concerned, because he said the trouble with most people is that they think that fairy tales, I think this was Tolkien who said this about fairy tales, is that they that because fairy tales have been relegated to children only and should never be used for adults. He said they are relegated to the nursery, which in England, of course, was a place where the children under 10 or 12 always lived with a nursemaid for most of their lives. And they put all the old furniture there, all the old books and all the old everything. And he said that's where the fairy tales finally ended up, because the adults quit reading them, and so they were dumped in the nursery. And that's why people think that they're just for children. Now, the the thing is that fairy tales, at their very beginning, were part of the heritage of adults as well as children. They were part of the heritage of the whole people. And they weren't necessarily fairy tales, they were tales. All stories were in that category. And now we get the feeling that stories, or fairy stories, or whatever you want to call them, only belong to children. Lewis said that if stories weren't interesting for adults, they were probably lousy for children too. And that if you think that you can write sort of a neat little story for children, it's probably not a very neat story for children. It has to be good for both. Now, I know some of you like Dr. Seuss, and I don't know how any adult could enjoy that, but maybe some adults do.
But that is not the category that these fairy tales are in, that Lewis was talking about. What Lewis is talking about is real writing. Real writing. Now, I don't know if any of you has read Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. Has anybody read that? Have you read it? Well, now, can you tell us a little bit about it? What it's involved in? Well, either one of you. Who else read it? Rue, did you? No, go ahead, Rue. I didn't see you say it. Well, either one of you. Well, that you don't have to finish it. I just want you to tell people what it's about. Is it about people?
It's about toads, the toad in the wolf, and the drifting badger.
Mm-hmm.
And about different things that you already did.
It's a story about animals who are not, they do not in any way resemble the Disney like figures that you have in Toad of Toad Hall, which I think was the adaptation of it in Disneyland, or in the Disney movies. The story of Wind in the Willows is a remarkable story of animals who live a life beside a river, and they keep house. Nobody knows where they get their food. There's nothing is said about going to the grocery store or where they get their clothes or how they do anything. It's all part of a marvelous little tale that doesn't require a lot of extra explanations. Lewis found that book when he was about 20. And he said he didn't think that he lost anything by not reading it as a child. He was delighted that he found it when he did, and he read it all through his life after that, reread it and enjoyed it all the way along. Now, those of you who haven't read it, I would strongly recommend that you look it up, because it is a classic, and one that would, I think, delight you. If you just would take the time to read it. But that was had a very great influence on C.S. Lewis in terms of style, because he realized that kind of writing was beautiful and impressive and fascinating no matter what age you were. And so he decided to write the same kind of thing when he started to write the Narnia books. The Narnia books are involved in the story of another world. The whole idea of another world is common to all these writers. All the Inklings are involved in the idea of another world. Not a world, you know, not heaven, not something that's going to take place after you die and you go to heaven, but a kind of parallel world that is somehow available to us as people and yet not available. You sense this, I think, even in Charles Williams, don't you think? Right. Even if there you get the feeling that it's almost another civilization, another time that you're in, you always get the feeling that this is a place where you could get to if you only knew how. The people who are in the Narnia books get to Narnia by chance through a wardrobe. Now, those of you who are young don't know what a wardrobe is, but those of us who are older can certainly, you can tell your age by the fact that you know what a wardrobe is. It's a great big cupboard-like thing that was usually set against a wall and had place in it for clothes to hang. And the children who were in the Narnia, who went through the Narnia experience, had to come out of London because of the war and were deposited at an old professor's house. And the way in which they got into Narnia was a sheer mistake. They were hiding in this wardrobe when some visitors were coming, and lo and behold, fell through the door and came into a world that was all covered with snow and was all full of woods, and it wasn't the next room at all. It was another world. And somehow, the great thing about this kind of imaginative writing that Lewis does is that he is able to do what Tolkien says is essential for good writing of imaginative literature. You have an inner consistency of reality. You have a willing suspension of disbelief, if you will, a feeling of, you don't care, you're not bothered by the fact that this is, why do you know that's impossible? You know very well that if you go through that door back there, that little kind of a cupboard thing there, right behind Elise, that you're going to get right into what was used to be the kitchen, but is now the one of the high school classrooms. I mean, you know that. Well, apparently, that's what they thought about this wardrobe, too. But once when they went through that wardrobe, it stayed a wardrobe. Another time when they went through it, it opened the door to Narnia. So how do you know? You know, sometimes it happens that way. And you have what Tolkien talked about, a belief in a primary world. In other words, I hit him and he knows I hit him. But you have that kind of an experience in a secondary world. In other words, a world of the imagination. And you actually have the feeling that you are identified with this world of Narnia that the children go through, in which they have all these tremendous experiences. There are seven of these books, and throughout the books, the figure of the lion, Aslan, is the dominant figure, although he's not always present, but he's always talked about. Now, there are a number of people who have read these books and have and disagreed very heartily with me that they had anything to do with Christianity. And I said, well, I think that's great that you don't think they have anything to do with Christianity, because that means that they did a very good job on being an entertaining book. They were not propaganda. In other words, they were not written with the idea to push something, although Lewis wanted to give Christianity some kind of a form that would be a snare, you might say, so that people wouldn't know that they were being caught by it. But he didn't want it. He never believed that anything should be written in terms of whether it's a story for children or a story for adults. That nothing should be written badly, so that it wasn't fun to read or exciting to read, just because it was going to talk about Christianity in some way or other. And, you know, I think that's a very good parallel to life in general, because a lot of people, you know, say, well, I'm sorry I'm dull, but, you know, I'm a Christian. Now, that's the way a lot of people's lives kind of impress you, that they've used their dullness as a kind of a as if that was a sort of a hallmark or a distinctive quality of being Christian, that being good means to be dull. Well, that's one thing that you find out in the Narnia books and in the three science fiction books that Lewis wrote. You never have the feeling that dullness is related to Christianity. The way in which he wrote was so not dull, so gripping and so exciting, that there was never any doubt that the book was going to carry you along if you had the mind to read it, and that you didn't have to read it because, you know, I've got to be a good girl or a good boy and read this good book now because because I'm good and I always do the right thing and I always read the kind of books I should read and this is the kind of book I should read. That kind of logic doesn't go with any of the books that come out of the Inklings. Those books are written so well and with such a lot of excitement that the people on the campuses who have read Tolkien, the people who are now reading Lewis, are not reading them because he's a Christian writer or that he's writing something that is going to do them good. They're reading him because he is an exciting writer and he's a good writer. And Lewis and Tolkien and all these men who were in the Inkling group felt that this was a primary quality in anything they did. There was never any more than there should be an excuse for the way in which John does those bricks over there, that because he's a Christian, he can do them not very well. His fight is always to try to get the best bricks he can, and he has a real fight about it, usually, because it's hard to find bricks. But and he tries to put them in the most beautiful way possible. He doesn't use his Christianity as an excuse for not doing the best and most beautiful job that can be done. I mean, this goes all the way through, but somehow we've got the idea that writing can be trivial, sloppy, sentimental, and because it has to do with Christianity, we can excuse it. That's no excuse for not having a good piece of work done in literature to say that it's Christian and therefore it can be any old thing, because somehow the Holy Spirit's going to take care of that. Well, I don't think there's ever any statement made in Scripture that the Holy Spirit takes care of laziness or poor work. And this is one of the lessons that is not always evident, because Lewis doesn't make any big sermons on this, but it's very true in the way in which those books are written. The books of science fiction were also part of some of his nightmares and some of his dreams. In fact, way back in 1927, Lewis had a complete dream about a trip to the moon. He wrote to his father about it and explained it and described it, and it's amazing because it does sound very much like what has happened, what we've heard about the moon itself. The only bad thing about it was a tall figure in black who came toward him. The closer he got, the more Lewis felt that he was going to have to meet this figure, and he didn't feel that he really wanted to meet him. And he said there was nothing but icy, cold caverns and mountains, and there was nothing growing on the moon. It was a complete waste, just a very barren place, very much like what we've heard about it. But he said this one figure came towards him, and finally he knew that he was going to have to meet him, and the man, if that's what it was, put out his arm to him, and when he put out his arm, instead of having a hand, it had a big ring on it, and the huge ring came around Lewis's wrist and grabbed him like that and hauled him off. And Lewis said, I mean, I woke up and I don't know where I went, you know, in the dream. Well, these are the kind of nightmares that apparently served to feed a lot of his science fiction, because those of you who, when you read his Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra and That Hideous Strength, realized that he couldn't possibly have cooked up all those all by himself. He's had some real inspirations for them. The first book of the science trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, has a great deal of, I think, I like it the best of the three. He liked Perelandra the best, and some people think that Hideous Strength has the most to say. But Out of the Silent Planet is one that I would strongly recommend anybody to read, simply because if the one thing that it does above all others, it makes you realize that Christianity isn't some little thing that has to do with a little, with this little earth and that's it. But you realize that your relationship to God is, that the God of the universe is so much bigger than anything that you had thought about. I know we always believe it, and you know we say it, but you've got to experience it to really feel it. And this is what you do in these novels. And I think this is one of the values of imaginative literature, is that again, you move into it and actually experience some of this so that it becomes a part of you. And you no longer speak so glibly about, well, I can't believe that, or I can believe this, or, you know, I don't know about that. I mean, you realize when you're talking about these things, you're dealing with huge truths that are much bigger and more cosmic than anything that you've thought about before. And that's what Lewis's novels do for you. It's interesting, how many of you have read anything by Arthur C. Clarke? He writes science fiction. This isn't a very science fiction group. He is a very good science fiction writer, and was one of the first of the writers of science fiction in the English world. He wrote a book called Childhood's End, which I remember our oldest daughter read and was really impressed with. She said it really got hold of her, and she, you know, it really shook her. He and Lewis had a good deal of correspondence back and forth about science, about writing science fiction, and the fact that science fiction is not. Of course, I realize that there's a lot of it that's pretty artificial and superficial. But many of the writers who wrote in the early days particularly were using a great deal of imaginative projection that today is no longer projection but actuality. Ray Bradbury himself was one who did quite a bit of that kind of writing, and certainly Arthur Clarke did. C.S. Lewis was asked to give, later on in life, was asked to give one of the main lectures at the Interplanetary Society in England, which was a very prestigious group. It was after some of the preliminary explorations had been going on for planning on a trip to the moon eventually. And they decided that Lewis had done more perhaps than almost anybody else in actually imagining the possibilities of other planets and what was on them. And they asked him to speak for this particular meeting, which was a very big one. And he said, well, he had said everything he had to say in his books, so he had nothing more to say. And therefore he was very sorry, but he would have to decline. But he appreciated the invitation. I thought, how few people ever have sense enough to say that they've said all that they had to say in their books, and therefore they have nothing more, but they appreciate the invitation, but will decline it. One of the things that you get out of the science fiction trilogy of Lewis's is that the other planets are not of necessity peopled with beings who are worse than we are. Now, why do we have the feeling that the people from Mars and the people from Jupiter and the people from anywhere are always going to have all the things that are the worst things that we have in ourselves? You know, it's almost as if you can't believe that God is bigger than we are, and that somehow we're the only ones that know what's right. Well, of course, you know yourself that if we know what's right, we're not doing it, obviously. So why we think that the people from other planets are going to be so much worse than we are always going to be a threat to us. The thing that Lewis makes very clear is that they're not. They're not going to be so much worse than we are. And the interesting way in which he peoples the other planets, and the fact that our planet is the planet that's lost And that's why it's called silent, because it no longer is in relationship with the other people who belong to the family of God. And I might say that he never mentions the word God, and he never uses anything, any term that vaguely reminds you of a catechism, a hymn book, a church service, or anything. There's nothing in any of the books that has a term that would remind you of any of the terms that we use for these experiences. And that's another thing that's very good about them is the fact that that's another way in which he catches people off guard. But the fact that all the people or the beings that are on all these planets are most of them are living in a state of grace. They're still living with God. They're still living in the family of the kingdom. Whereas, you know, what happened, those of you who have been to Milton know what happened, if you don't remember Genesis, when Satan had the fight in heaven and was able to get at all of the people who were going to be on earth from the time of the beginning and until this very day. The silence of our planet then is the sort of the point of this whole story, and then what happens to a man who goes to another planet and discovers that the people who live on that planet are in a quite a different relationship in the kingdom. I think that of all the books that I would certainly recommend, I think the first one is the one that I recall as being the most exciting to me. But you may have to read another one later, so I don't know. I don't dare to suggest it. I discovered that Hideous Strength is the novel that he wrote along with the book on the abolition of man, which was a collection of lectures that he gave at the University of Durham. So you may maybe John will think you have to read that. So you might read that one, although it is the third in the trilogy and actually comes out of the development of the three. You can read any one of them at any time. This is also true of the Narnia series. You can take any of those books and read them. You don't have to read them in a chronological order because each one is sufficient unto itself. It has its own meaning and its own story. So you don't have to depend on previous stories in order to understand them. And I think this is extremely important because of the fact that your whole understanding of all of his works is such that you can cut through them anywhere and you find basically something that will feed you and help you to grow no matter where you hit it. I want to read in closing one thing about Lewis that I think epitomizes very much what his I wanted to get the last battle, but I didn't get down here early enough to get it from the library, so I have to read the quotation. But this is the way he ends this one of the last of the Narnia books. And the great thing about it is that this is really the way you feel when you read his fiction, that this is his convinced belief that the way in which the last battle closes and the way in which he writes it is his understanding of what life in God is. You have to understand it from the point of view of the power of an imagination that has been made captive to Christ. Then Aslan turned to them and said, "You are, as you used to call it in the Shadowlands," that's this world, "dead. The term is over. The holidays have begun. The dream is ended. This is the morning." And then he says, and then Lewis says this, "And for us, this is the end of all the stories, and we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. Tomorrow we'll talk about Charles Williams. If you don't have too much of the wasteland to deal with, you'll see how to get along.
Thanks, Mary.